Hey there, everyone, and welcome back to the Percussion Pedagogy Podcast. I got a special episode for you here with instrument maker, creator, deep thinker, beer enthusiast, Jeff Luft of Luft Mallets. If you don't know about his mallets, stop the podcast, head over to the bio, and click his link and check out the handmade, high-quality mallets that he produces. I've known about them since I was in undergrad, and if you're a professional timpanist, you already know about them. If you aren't a professional timpanist, get to know about them. I really enjoyed this episode, and I think you will too. You guys know the drill. I'm going to shut up and let this guy do the talking.
I started fairly late with music. You know, a lot of, seems like everybody in the classical world, or especially compared to violinists, and they all start when they're 5 or 6 or have family members that are musicians. Nobody in my family is a musician. But yeah, I was probably, I think, 13 when I got my first pair of sticks. Up till then, I just played sports. It was baseball, soccer, roller hockey, because we were in Florida.
Yeah.
So it was always sports. It was always outdoors. I was always outdoors, either fishing, running around, doing whatever. So, but yeah, our neighbor, he was a rock drummer, really loved Fish, which I knew nothing about, the band Fish.
Yeah,
I
guess.
Yeah, I would hear him play every now and then. I was just like, this is, I want to do that. I mean, it sounds magical when you hear somebody play drums and you don't play drums. You're like, how can a human do that?
Yeah.
So I asked my mom for some drumsticks, or my parents for some drumsticks. And yeah, started fairly late. And I was still trying to play. I played baseball in high school, and I was trying to do both band and high school. And in the South, especially in like Texas and Florida, like, it's a huge deal, marching bands. Like, yeah, we were a great marching band, and we had a great band program, and we had a very strong baseball program, but it was always trying to, I'd do 6 months straight of baseball, then I'd all of a sudden go back. I mean, I was still in band, but I was just barely making it as a band kid.
Yeah.
Until baseball was over. And then, I think it was like, probably my sophomore year, junior year, I'm like 6'1", 200 pounds. I'm a bigger, above average person, but in high school, I was not until like my senior year. I didn't get very big until later on. So my body just could not keep up with most high school kids on the baseball team. I started to realize that I could, there's a limit to what you can do when you're exercising and reach your limits with what your body can do. And I was just working so hard, I was getting tendonitis in my arm and messing up my knees. And I was just like, well, I can go sit in a practice room or marching band. And it's strenuous, of course, but it's like, hey, if I want to do 6 hours of practice, I can do it, as long as you do it with good technique and, you know, all that stuff. So I started to shift. Like, I was like, okay, if I work just as hard in music, which I really loved, and my brain kind of got, it's like the problem solving aspect of music, you know, then my brain, it made sense to my brain, and learning scales and all rudiments and all that stuff. And yeah. So, and at that point it was just like, okay. And then we got very fortunate that we got a new percussion instructor at our school who was classically trained. He went to Eastman, he went to Cleveland Institute of Music, phenomenal. And he was from Florida. But when he was doing auditions and practicing a lot, he developed focal dystonia. So he could play for 10 minutes, and then all of a sudden his hands would like shake uncontrollably. Yeah. So he lost his ability to do what he wanted to do.
Wow.
But because of that, me and my friend Sergio Carreno, he plays in Oregon Symphony out in Portland, Oregon. We went to middle school and high school together, but we really got lucky that our teacher had this horrible debilitating thing happen to him. And then he ended up moving back home and became our percussion instructor.
Yeah.
And then we heard him play like scales, and granted he can't practice much, but when you hear somebody who's put in a ton of hours, they can still do it for a little bit of time, you know? And it was just like, oh my God.
Yeah.
It's, you know, when you hear somebody play something clean and just clean on a mallet instrument, you're just like, oh my God, I didn't know that was possible.
Yeah, yeah.
So he really got my brain going on classical stuff. And then I was like, then he showed me, like you were saying, Beethoven, and then like how other different things, like Sense de Maya, lots of different things, weird things, revueltas. And he would just open our brains to it. And it was just like, whoa, this is cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it was just down the obsession rabbit hole, like I am doing now, but with mallets. But then, yeah, ended up, he studied with Tim Adams, who was at Carnegie Mellon. And then he was like, yeah, you should go there. And we're like, okay, I don't know if we can do this. So we had a couple, you know, I had a Florida school because of the in-school tuition, and we, University of South Florida with Bob McCormick.
Oh yeah.
And a couple other schools, Boston Conservatory, Cleveland Institute, Carnegie Mellon, and got into them, and then ended up just going to study with Tim because I don't know. Or my teacher told us to do it, and Tim's a great teacher, great player.
Incredible. So. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And what were your plans? Were you like, I want to be a timpanist, or were you just kind of like, I'm going to go and experience it?
Yeah, I didn't care. I just wanted to, I wanted to do everything, percussion or timpani.
Nice.
Tim is, you know, he was a timpanist with Pittsburgh Symphony. And, but he didn't just teach us timpani. I didn't go there just to be a timpanist. He wanted us to be well-rounded in everything too. So, and just by sheer numbers, and probably just because of the amount of hours I put in playing snare line and just having so much more time on snare drum and mallet instruments, I guess I just ended up gravitating towards that. And then, that was my focus. Basically, I wanted to win a job. I wanted to get a job and everything would take care of itself.
Yeah. That's the dream.
It's usually what people are thinking.
Yeah. 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 And then when did you decide, okay, I guess maybe I should back up a little bit. When did you start making your own mallets then? I remember reading in your about section about, Tim trying out your mallets and like you kind of getting into it then, but like, when did you start? Like, have you always been hands-on, or is it something you did out of necessity?
It was a little bit of both, I guess. It was in high school, same teacher, the percussion instructor that moved back. When we got to like our junior year or something like that, and we were starting to do timpani, more timpani, he brought in some mallets that he had made.
Oh.
And I don't know why he made them. Probably it was the same thing because he lived in Florida. and there's plant nurseries everywhere.
Mm.
You can go, and they always, and they use the bamboo to stake saplings too.
Ah.
So there it was. It was everywhere. I mean, I could go to 500 different nurseries. I lived in a suburban area, but like you could drive 15 minutes and be in an industrial and kind of farmy type area. So it wasn't too hard. And my dad worked out in the Everglades and liked working with plants. So he knew. He wasn't like super into it, but if I asked him a question, he'd be like, yeah, you can go there. I didn't have a car. I'd have a friend and we'd go bother these people at plant nurseries and ask them, or floral shops. I went to a couple of floral shops.
Cool.
And the bamboo was kind of crappy, I thought, or what I thought at that time. I mean, I knew I was just basing my concept of what a timpani mallet should look like by my teacher's five pairs that he made. So,
sure.
But you know, you wanted it to be straight and a decent weight or something like that. But yeah, I started doing it junior year. I think I made maybe a couple pairs. I still have two or three that I made when I was in high school. Cool. And they're pretty good, surprisingly. Nice. But nice. I had to, yeah, so then it was a matter of it's just like everything. Even nowadays when I'm messing around with the tambourines and drum pads and stuff, it's always about finding the supplier, finding the quality materials. So I found a landscaping supply company in Plantation or Pompano Beach. Mm-hmm. And they just sold, you know, they sold, and they were the people that sold to the nurseries. So that was a good education at first. Like, don't just go to the nurseries because they'll give you a stake of bamboo, but you're going to get one, or they're going to charge you $8 for it or something.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, well, where do they get it? So then I went and looked in the phone book back in the day. This was like 98, 99. And I just looked up landscaping supply companies in the yellow pages and started doing it by then. I mean, I had to go through thousands of feet of bamboo to get a decent pair.
Oh, wow.
But that was also a great education because I learned a lot trying to figure out what it's supposed to look like, what it normally looks like at a certain diameter and weighs like, you know, kind of develop, okay, what's light, what's medium, what's heavy from the source, and then cutting it down and figuring out how to cut bamboo. I had to get the right saw to cut the bamboo so it wouldn't just rip out. So there was all kinds of stuff that I started to figure out then, really early. Yeah.
Wow. And then how did you take that information and then when you're in school, like apply it there and then onto your company?
Yeah, I guess lots of times, and the reason I think I started to do more of it was, you know, Tim would tell us, you know, get the Duff set. This was when Adams was making the Duff series, the eight pairs. And we'd get it when we could afford it. And I'd get enough to get the set, like every Christmas, get a pair or two or something like that. And then, so the thing I would notice is Tim would have stuff that he had gotten from Duff that Duff had made or had. I don't think Duff ever actually made any of the sticks. He had somebody make them for him, but he would give his students a set of sticks when they went to Cleveland Institute.
Ooh.
I don't know if they had to buy them or if he made them for him. I honestly don't remember, but Tim had those in his case and I saw them and I'd be sneaking through there being like, and he was cool with it. He wanted to show us, but we'd do mallet wrapping things. And then I'd look at his and I'd be like, these don't look anything like the Adams Duff sticks. And it was different species of bamboo. And then, you know, you'd feel it. And then my classmates would get the same thing. And some of them would be really thick. Some of them would be super light. And they'd be like, and then, you know, you always have that thing no matter what. Whatever somebody else has, you think it's a little better.
Or
sometimes it is too, you know, it's just different. And then you got to figure out, okay, what's different about it? Is it heavier? Or is it the thickness? So it's always kind of trying to find that sweet spot of, okay, those look good. So when I go home over Christmas break or the summer, I'm going to try and do that or remember what I liked about it. And it was always just kind of looking at, I mean, those were my models because that's what my teacher had and told us to get. So that's kind of how I did that. But it was always a matter of seeing, you know, you'd get seven pairs of ones or twos. And they'd all be a little bit different. And then everybody would be like, yeah, you got to use Eric's, man. His are the best. And then I'd be like, Eric, let me see your sticks. Why are these so, what makes them so good or whatever? So it was always that. It was always trial and error. Nothing about it was super scientific other than feel. Like, this feels good. Okay, why does this feel good? And then try and reverse engineer it from there.
Yeah. And do you still follow that same concept? Are you always tinkering or do you think you found kind of a groove in your set?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I can do timpani mallets in my sleep now. and also I know what, like I was saying, developing what's light. Of course, everybody's opinions are going to be different depending on your hands, your strength, all that stuff. So, but in general, for me, categorizing what's the most useful, what have I sent out the most that people like, or what are the emails I've gotten from people saying they want something like X person's stick. For years, I kept track of every single weight that I sent out. I don't do that anymore, but like that was helpful. It was like, oh, people really like this weight or whatever. Because there's going to be variance no matter what, but in general, people are going to figure out overall what the best, most useful material and materials are. So
yeah, I like that process. I mean, you know, it seems like it's taken a long time, but it's like, you know, it now, you know, all the details. Mm-hmm. You can probably just look and be like, that's 72 grams, you know, like, or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Ed, I haven't hung out with Ed in a while, but when we were doing stuff and I think when we were developing the line, he would hand me a stick that I'd made a while. And he's like, how much does this weigh? And he would make me guess. And I'd get within a gram, which was pretty good. And,
yeah.
But I didn't weigh them until maybe 10 years ago. Probably 10 years ago. It was always just like, all right, lift this one, lift that one. go back and forth. I didn't even think, like, I also wasn't like, this is going to be my life. This is going to be my business.
Sure.
You know, it was like, it was just kind of a side hustle for a long time. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Well, I kind of mentioned this before, like when I was studying with Ken, just kind of getting ready for graduate school, he showed me a pair of your mallets, actually a couple pairs. And I was kind of blown away at the time. You know, I was young and I was just kind of like going, I didn't know you can custom order mallets. I didn't know you could be that specific. So I'm curious, for your professional clients, can you take us through the process of how you go from the initial email or phone call to getting them the final product?
Yeah, I guess for the most part, lots of times for people that are in, like, I don't know, bigger full-time jobs, just playing timpani, it always kind of, sometimes they find out first, like, oh, Jeff makes sticks or Luft mallets is a thing. Or sometimes their students will come in and they'll be teaching lessons and then they'll pick up the sticks and be like, oh, those are pretty good.
Yeah.
And then I'll get an email from them. And yeah, for the most part, I guess, you know, lots of times, I'm trying to think now, well, I guess the good thing is, I'm not trying to dodge a question or anything. I'm just thinking, like, especially now since I have like two timpanists, like on my line, I have like two professional timpanists for a line, that kind of takes care of itself in a way. Like, they, people will either, and also thinks also sometimes people who have bigger jobs don't want to use somebody else's sticks with somebody's name on it.
Sure.
So lots of times I'll make sticks that are similar to what some people have seen, but put it on bamboo or put it on a blank carbon fiber shaft. And I don't think all of that is ego, but that's definitely some of it. And also some people like bamboo, like, so, and also I need to consider too, like, people in one hall might not work in another hall with a different group. So
yeah,
they'll ask. Yeah. So I guess to get back to your question, they'll want something that's like X, but couldn't it be a few grams lighter, a slightly bigger core, or sometimes they'll just change the core material altogether for a balance that they're looking for to either fit the acoustic or their technique.
And do you go, like, is it something like you mail out a set and you say, try this, and then mail it back, and then you'll tinker with it and you just go back and forth like that? Is that kind
of... Yeah, it depends. Sometimes I don't really want it to get to the point where I'm wasting my time.
Sure.
No, or no. So, like, and most people are cool that they won't try and take advantage of that, because I'll just be like, all right, I'm done. I mean, I don't, if you can't give me more specifics or you're not willing to pay me for my time, then I kind of have to, I can't just burn material. And I did that for a long time and that helped. I would make stuff, people would try it, they'd send it back. And then I would take that stuff, send it to other people. And eventually it got sold, but it's not a good way to run a business to hope that it all sells. Or lots of times what I would find is I would use up material. And when somebody would ask for a custom material, that material was like bamboo, for instance.
Hmm.
That material was used up by prototypes I made for somebody else. So then I had to order more material from China, or it was just like, so I've been trying to, at this point, people, enough of my stuff is out there. A lot of people can point to something and I can remember exactly what I did. So.
Got you. I'm curious, maybe more specifically, like, let's say there's a college kid out there doing some gigging and just for, you know, auditions and stuff. Is there a certain set or like maybe pieces of a set in your lines that you would recommend them to go for?
Yeah, you know, the two lines, the Ed Stephenson line and then Leo's, the Leonardo Soto, you know, there's always going to be a hard, medium, soft in every line of sticks. Their two sets are very different in the balance and the design. But yeah, for sure. Like on Ed's, for like a soft, medium, and a hard, it would be like the 3ES3. It's a big ball stick, cork ball stick. And then the Badass, which is the ES6, which I it's that, and we did that, I think that was like 2009 or 10, like when I was just kind of starting to make more sticks, and I didn't care. And I still don't really run my business like I need to be. I don't know. I'm not doing stuff to be, to draw attention. It was just fun, you know? And Ed said I should call it the badass. And I'm like, sure, I'll call it the badass. Why not?
Yeah, well, it makes me want to buy it. Like, I'm down with it.
Yeah, and that works out too. I think people buy it because it's called that. But we did that. You know, I can see other businesses saying, all right, they get a team, or like, I don't know, I don't want to make fun of other makers or something like that. But even in any other field, they'll name something like the Excalibur or something. I don't know.
No, I got you. I see where you're going.
Yeah. But anyways, that's a great stick. It's just so versatile. And then that's the ES6. And then something hard, it'd be like a 10 or 11, ES10 or ES11. So it's basically a German ball. And I have different densities of German felt. This is just, again, stuff that I've been interested in over the years. And I'd contact felt companies, and I'd ask, do you have any other types of felts? And then they'd send it to me, and then I'd tweak it. And then luckily with that one, I bought a certain type of dense German felt. And that's the one I had used for the badass when I sent it to Ed. And I was like, oh, cool. This is useful. And this is useful in a multitude of different sticks.
Yeah.
So that's a dense German felt, and then an American felt, harder, dense felt for the 10 or 11.
Cool.
And then on Leo's, it would be the same thing. Like his go in reverse. Ed's go from soft to hard. Leo's go from hard to soft in the numbering system. But same thing. You can take something in the early part of the middle, and then the end. It's, if you had to choose three, because you can get through a lot of stuff. I mean, I've had people over the years that have bought dozens of sticks, and it's great for me, but it's a little mind-boggling. But also, it's not at the same time, because people are always auditioning at different halls. Their technique may change, or they may go study with somebody, and they'll say, "Yeah, those sticks aren't working for you," and then they might come to me and try something else. So I can understand why people go through a ton of sticks, but to answer your question, for a college kid, yeah, you can get through a lot and understand how the sticks can help manipulate, you know, the sound and articulation with just three pairs, for sure.
Yeah, I like that. Thanks.
Yeah,
I think that will help guide some people, because sometimes they see a line, they're like, I need to buy the whole line, which is great for business. But it might be helpful to have a couple.
And people email me all the time. They ask me what I would get, and I have no problem. If they say I only have enough money for two sticks, then yeah, we'll make it work for sure.
Cool.
Or ask them what they have, and then I've seen enough sticks over the years and fixed, or not fixed, but rewrapped enough sticks over the years. Sorry.
No, you're good.
So I've like, and that's true too, actually. And I learned a lot by fixing a lot of European stuff, like Kato. And Kappert. I had a lot of people when I was just starting out, back when those were really popular because of Marcus Roten, who won the job in New York Phil. So a lot of people started using those sticks, and then the bamboo would break or the flannel would come loose. And these were people that I were friends with that I went to music school or summer festivals with.
Gotcha.
And they'd send it to me, and then I'd be like, what is going on here? Sometimes it was like, that seems like a poor engineering decision. And then sometimes I was like, wow, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, how did they do that? And try and adapt that without just saying, all right, I'm just going to copy this and just make it. But it was interesting to kind of discover what other people were doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
That way. So
that is that, I would assume that would be very beneficial for a maker.
Totally. It really was. And the great part was people would send them to me. Like, I wouldn't have to buy them and then deconstruct them. So
yeah. Well, I'm curious what you think about like students kind of getting into wrapping their own mallets. I you know, in my undergrad we had a couple classes about marimba mallet wrapping and things like that, or how to repair, you know, a cartwheel or something like that. Do you think it's important for students to kind of get into mallet wrapping, and if so, like, how do they get started?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's helpful. Maybe it just to understand like the challenges of it, And then also to see what you're, if you're good at it. I had an aptitude for it for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. Maybe, I mean, like I told you before, maybe before we started rolling, I fished all the time growing up. I was constantly tying knots and doing stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I actually made a bunch of lures when I was old. I made molds for different worms and stuff like that. I mean, nice. I was into it, man.
That's cool. That's hard.
So I think by doing stuff like that, maybe that increased my skill, you know, or my aptitude for figuring out how to make something, because you got to kind of understand what the material is going to do when you pull it, when it's going to break, how thick you should make the felt. It's a lot of trial and error, but certain people have an aptitude for it, period, you know? Yeah, yeah. And if you start doing it and you're like, whoa, I'm pretty good at this, then yeah, definitely keep pursuing it. Some people are just not going to get it.
Yeah, like
that's
me.
Not, it's not to be a jerk. I'm not good at a lot of other things, but like knowing if you're good at it, then, you know, refine it. But that's also not to say if you start out and you're horrible at it, you can, it's all about how much patience you have, really. But yeah, I definitely think people should try and do it. And also I would love for people to try and do it and then realize, you know, when you see other people's work, other makers, there's a reason why people charge a certain amount, or there's a reason people think a certain brand is good. And generally it's because the work is done well. And if you've actually tried to do it and then you can see it, you could be like, wow, I can see what the problem is. Or I can, more importantly, you should be able to hear it. Like when you hear a well-wrapped stick versus a not well-wrapped stick, it's obvious. Not all the time, but on certain models or, you know, stuff that needs a lot more precision in the measuring and the sewing, it's pretty obvious, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
To the ear, not just the eye test.
Got you. Yeah. I didn't think about that aspect of it, like to actually be able to hear more in depth, like what's going on.
And I think Amy's book is great. Amy Stubbs has a sewing.
Oh yeah.
Mallet wrapping book. She's another Carnegie Mellon alum, but we weren't in school at the same time, but yeah, she spells it out. I don't think we do the sewing the same way, but whatever. I learned one way. I saw Tim do it, and he probably saw Duff do it, and there's probably better ways to do it, but I've done it enough that I make it work for me.
Yeah.
Basically. So
absolutely.
So yeah.
Well, cool. Thank you for that.
Sure.
Maybe switching gears for a second. I've seen in the last couple of years you putting out other instruments and like pads. Can you talk a little bit about your woodblocks and tambourines and specifically the burine? I'm really curious about that bad boy. Some of my friends just got it and they love it.
Oh, cool. Yeah. They're fun. I guess so. Like up till 2015, 2016, I got a job with Dayton Philharmonic playing percussion there right out of grad school. And I'd been there for 15 years, basically, 2005, 2006 season. And in between that time, I was taking auditions, every audition I could get ready for. And then when I wasn't, and there's, you know, there's only so many hours a day you can practice and want to practice. So I would just practice as much as I can, then do a little sticks. If a friend would ask me for some stuff, I'd chip away at that a little bit. But up till this will get to the drum pads, I promise.
Oh, you're good.
But up until that time, I mean, it was just like, I need to get a bigger job. I need to get a job that pays health insurance better and all that stuff, you know? So after like 2015, 2016, I'd been doing my business, on the side for, and it had been growing a little bit each year. Just again, I had a website, and I did a little bit on Facebook and Instagram, but that was it. There was no, I was just selling from my website, and I was cool with that because I could keep up with it and still practice 6-8 hours a day or whatever I was doing for an audition. Sure. And so around 15, 16, I was just like, all right, I think I've had enough of this.
Nice.
I don't know. You, at a certain point, you know, I get really nice emails from people over the years. And people tell you you're really good at something. And granted, you win a job and you have success being a classical musician. That's great. You're obviously doing the right thing, but it's a grind, you know?
Yeah.
So especially doing auditions, and then you'll have, you know, you'll make it to semis or finals, and then all of a sudden you don't advance for a year, and it's like, good Lord, this sucks.
Yeah. Worse than that.
Yeah. And then like, behind the scenes the whole time I'm making sticks, and I'm a percussionist as my job. Mm. I don't hardly play timpani anymore, but, so I was always doing the timpani thing as a side, but it kept growing and people were really complimenting me. And then Ed had a lot of success. He won like five jobs and five, I don't know, something crazy.
Yeah.
So, and then we hooked up right at the right time, and it kept growing. And then I was like, all right, I'm going to do this more full time. So I sold some instruments that I didn't need and we bought a house like 7-8 years ago, 2012, something like that.
Nice.
So I had a little bit more space to like actually do stuff,
mm-hmm.
Build stuff. Like timpani mallets doesn't take a ton of space.
Oh, okay.
It's like a drill press, a handsaw, and a disc sander. That's kind of what I do. That's all I need.
Nice.
So it doesn't need a ton of space. But when we got the house, and then I was kind of like, all right, I'm going to focus more on my business. I bought a bunch of tools with instruments and I sold. So then I had these instruments, or had these tools, you know, nicer tools, like, you know, good stuff. And yeah, so I started building more things. And then, the drum pads, I didn't even think about doing it. Leo suggested that I do it.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, I don't think I want to do that. Amy makes a great pad. It's, you know, I don't need to make a pad. And his push, because there was a lot of timpani and percussion auditions, or percussion assistant timpani auditions.
Yeah.
And he's like, you should do it. I mean, I see a lot of people using pads in the warm-up room. And if you had a double sided one, I was like, okay. So then I didn't even draw it. I just made it, and he liked it. And then, but it was a lot more behind that than what I
should. Oh, no, of course. Of course. Of course.
I mean, I've been studying woodworking via YouTube and classes and reading books for since 2015, 16, like serious, like I'm obsessed with it. Like,
of course,
like, yeah. You know, so that was my time, kind of studying to become better at woodworking and making other products. That wasn't the end game. But when Leo suggested that, I was like, yeah, I like woodworking and I like drums, so I can make this. And then I just tried to make it as pretty and as best as I could for the drum pads. And then the pandemic stuff happened. And I had been hoarding beer bottle caps from myself and kind of hangouts and parties or whatever over the years. And I had a giant Ziploc bag full of beer bottle caps. Sure. And I always thought they sounded kind of cool, but also I just thought that the caps were cool, you know, especially with the whole microbrew stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Some people were doing really beautiful design. And I was like, I'm going to keep those. Those are too pretty to throw away.
Absolutely.
And I thought, I'm going to make a tambourine out of that. And I tried to make a tambourine out of that. It sounded like crap. Unless you played it like two Fs the whole time.
Oh, yeah.
But that informed my process. And then I was like, oh, so it needs to be bigger. And I was like, okay, so then I need to find metal. And I was like, what kind of metal? What kind of thickness? And that kind of led to the tambourines that I'm doing now.
Mm-hmm.
But the drum pad thing, the beerine, it was like, okay, it doesn't sound good as a tambourine. But so then I thought, okay, well, what if I, you know, I actually took one of my rectangular drum pads,
okay,
prototypes that I'd made with Leo, or for Leo, and I cut slots into that and put jingles around it, almost like a hand drum that has the,
yeah, like a Rick or something like that.
Yeah, 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 almost like that. And it sounded okay. And I was like, it sounded decent. So then again, I just went, my mind just gets consumed with like figuring out how it can sound and kind of look decent. And I bought a couple shells, ply shells off eBay from Keller. They make a bunch of, I think they sell their seconds on eBay. But I bought one of those shells, It was like a 15-inch tall shell, cut it into pieces. And then, I had to figure out. So then I had to figure out how to get the right diameter rubber. So I had to have a rubber company in town here make it for me. And
oh, cool.
Yeah, there was all kinds of stuff. But yeah, it was trial and error. It was all trial and error. You know, my 4-year-old daughter was hanging out all the time, and she was probably 3 at the time. But yeah, I'd try and do a little bit here and there, and it was just fun. And they sound great. They're really fun.
Yes,
they were a ton of work, but I don't think I'm going to do them anymore, honestly. But
oh, really?
Unfortunately, I mean. Yeah, unfortunately, there's just too much work. I mean, I don't want to ask what I want for them because people will just be like, it's ridiculous.
I mean, it's hand-made, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's right. I've had people kindly donate over the years, too. Yeah. But yeah, I've had a few beers.
Might as well. I'm a big craft brew fan, so I appreciate it. Like when I'm looking at it. Yeah, one of my friends, Tony Steve, he teaches in Jacksonville University.
Oh, yeah.
He sent me videos and stuff. He's like, you got to get one of these things. And he's like always practicing on it. He loves that thing.
Yeah. They're fun. And I wanted them to feel good and sound good. And that's the good thing about, being a player. Like I know what feels good. I know what sounds good from my years of study and, developing, I guess, good taste by practicing and refining over the years. So I was like, all right, well, I want this to sound good. And there was many, I shared a lot of it on Instagram, but there was so many frustrating things to figure out. But it was fun. I was like, nobody else has done this. I guess I'll, and it, whenever you say that nobody else has done this for me, it's always like, okay, has nobody else done this because it's a good idea or a horrible idea?
Sure. Yeah. That's a good question to ask.
So yeah, it was a good idea because it was cool and it sounded good and it was fun, but it was the reason nobody's really done it is because it's tricky to do, like to get it to sound good on both sides and have a good response. And yeah, all those things that I want the products I make to be, you know, I don't want them to just be gimmicky or whatever, you know, I want them to be useful. They should be useful if I'm spending my time on it. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, speaking, let's hang right there for a second. You said you want them to be useful and not gimmicky. My favorite part about your website and just in general is this one section. And on your about section, I think it's absolutely perfect. You say there's no corporate slogan, there's no BS marketing team, and there's no pages of phony endorsements. I just want my products to speak for themselves. I think that, like, finally something very true to the point. No BS, and I really like that. And me personally, I know because everyone I know uses your stuff, and so I know that the products speak for themselves. But let's just say, for example, that you absolutely had to come up with a sales pitch. What would you say about your products?
I don't know if I'm going to be good at this, Tommy.
You can also say I don't want to. That's cool too.
I don't know. Like whenever I buy. Trying to think when I buy, I guess other tools or what's something I bought in the. So like when I got on Instagram, like I followed was woodworkers. Like I didn't want to follow other. I was burnt out. I was like, I've heard enough about products being sold to me over the years. Like you need this because this is the next thing and this is how you're gonna get the gig, quote unquote, sure. Joke or whatever. So I just wanted to. And I've always enjoyed woodworking, or my dad did a little bit, but I liked seeing a unclean, dirty piece of lumber being manipulated and cut into something that's beautiful. Hmm. That's always appealed to me. I didn't know that, like, but I've always been attracted to that transformation.
Yeah.
So I followed woodworkers and I just saw all these people who are like me. But doing something completely different, like people that make tools. And I would gladly pay them, even though they're way more than what you would get on Amazon or Home Depot or whatever woodcraft store, stuff like that. And the reason I would do that is because they've spent an enormous amount of time thinking about it. Just to say, okay, I'm going to make a for instance, like a spoke shave. You know what a spoke shave is?
I don't know.
It's lots of times it's used for making, it takes little bits of wood. It's like a little plane.
Okay.
That you hold with two handles, and it's got a little blade right in the middle. It's a very simple tool. It's been around forever, but I don't mention exact names, but there's people that make tools like that, and they're doing them, they're refining them, or investing time into making it better.
Mm.
Better as in like it's more useful overall. Better as in like the materials are better. Like they're choosing the wood for a certain reason. They're designing the handles on it for a certain reason. All those things, like, they're controlling it from the beginning to the end.
Yeah.
And what comes out is usually, almost always, especially when you're dealing with people that have done this for a while, what comes out of that is a superior product. Like, you know, and that may not be obvious to everybody at all levels, but like people who've put in the time, once they hold it, they're just like, yeah, that's better.
Yeah.
Now, what's better about it, they might not be able to explain. It feels better in your hand. Why? Because the person who engineered it is a woodworker and is a toolmaker, and they made it to be more useful and better.
Yeah.
Not just to, yeah, I mean, for timpani mallets and stuff like that, it's not something you just, you know, you're not just going to get somebody to do that. You'd have so much to explain to them, like, why. You can say you wrap it in felt. Okay. there's like 30 different levels to that. You know what I mean?
I believe it.
Not just the end product of like you're on a stage or you're in an audition and you want to convey this type of feeling. So I guess the sales pitch is like, you know, I've kind of lived it for a while, and it's been a slow process of learning and making those connections. And if people don't get that, fine. That's totally cool. Go buy something else. I'm not going to beg for people's business, but when you see a good product, my product or anybody else's in the percussion industry, and you hold it, you're like, that's better. And then lots of times, I think about this a lot, it's like, okay, how much better is what I'm doing than somebody else? Or how much better is what somebody else is doing than what I'm doing? And generally it's, you know, it's not like this is 200% better. Hmm. Unless you go from like an Orff instrument to a Deegan A70 or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
But when you go from like an Adams instrument to a Yamaha to a Musser xylophone, they're all good. Some are better for certain things, but like what makes it, you know, these more artisan or niche makers better? It's 10% better, but that 10% is hard to get to.
And you can hear it, especially people that have been doing it a long time. Yeah. Like some upcoming people on the show are going to be like Matt Nolan.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool. Yeah.
And Doug DeMauro. We're very fortunate. My university has a DeMauro instrument, and he's only,
right.
He's only a couple hours away, and he's come up and done master classes and clinics for my students. And mm-hmm. even a junior high kid, when DeMauro walks in the room first, they go like, holy crap, a mountain man. But then they like see him go to his instrument, and he'll hit it, and he'll reach down and like turn one little knob underneath, like all the resonators are tunable, and their eyes like light up, like it's mm-hmm. nothing. Like even a junior high kid can hear it. And so it's cool, like you're saying, a true artisan, you can hear the difference. And the ones that really hear it, it's like if you're already doing professional orchestras and you hear a Matt Nolan triangle versus mm-hmm. whatever triangle, you know, it's a huge difference.
Yeah, and one thing I'll add to that, like, you compare one of Matt's triangles to a Sabian, and I'm not digging on Sabian. Sabian makes some beautiful stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But this goes back to what I was saying about timpani mallets 20 years ago is, okay, if I buy 7 pairs of X mallets back then, one of them was really good. One pair was really good.
Yeah.
So and when you buy anything from Matt, it's going to be really good.
Yeah, it will be. Yes.
You know what I mean? Your percentages are the quality is higher all the time. I've played on some Sabians or whatever, X-Maker. I don't want to.
No, you're good. You're good.
Crash anybody, but it's like, you know, sometimes you got to go through 20 to get one that sounds like your friends or whatever, and that's annoying, and that's really why I started doing sticks more for my friends, and is because they could just tell me what they wanted and I'd make it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I was like, whoa, people will pay me to do that, and yeah.
Just go figure that, you know, it's like you get paid for the work that you do, but the work is like the years, like you're talking about in junior and in high school all the way until now, you've been tinkering. I mean, you can't replace that with a machine, at least not. I don't think you can. Maybe you can get close, but that's just that's cool. That's a hell of a sales pitch. I like that.
I hadn't really made that connection. I mean, I guess I have, but it's like, I've also wanted to run my business like that, but it's really hard. You gotta.
Oh, it is. Yeah, I believe it.
It's like, I'm going to just work for 2 months and then all of a sudden put out a batch of sticks and people will buy them. That's cool, but I still got to make income in those 2 months. Mm. You know what I mean? That's what a lot of these tool makers and other artisans do. They've gotten ahead of the curve by doing this for so many years, or they've set up their business that they can do that and just kind of work, and then all of a sudden they've got 150 of X tool, and then in an hour they're gone because if people want them. I was like, I'd love to do that, but it's not the same. For maybe tambourines might be like that at some point if we ever all get back to work, which we will, but you know, I don't think timpani mallets will really be like that. But anyways, just kind of, I've always thought about that. I was like, that's a really great way to like focus on your work, you know, not like purposefully make your, what is it? Not purposely make your products rare, but like you're doing that so you can work and make them a high quality. So
exactly. Yeah. Well, thanks for doing that. I know that's probably not part of your, I mean, it's obviously that's not part of your bag with the slogan like that, but I think it works. You know, I really do think it works. So I just have like maybe one more for you. Sure. And this is something I ask everybody, just kind of a closer. It's what life lessons that can be music related or not have you learned along the way that have really shaped you as a person?
I guess the biggest thing for me is always take in as much information as you can get, like without being, you know, granted, I'm a pretty obsessive person. Like when I would get into something, like I want to know everything about it. But like with music, it was always like, okay, I want to be an orchestral musician. And this definitely came from Tim too, because Tim loved jazz. He did a lot of other things. Whenever we were hanging out, he was not listening to classical music. It was always other things. And then that makes you a better classical musician.
Yeah.
And then seeing that parallel in what I do now with, you know, making things all the time or making products all the time is, you know, like I said, I follow a lot of woodworkers, not other percussion companies or whatever. Is, you know, I've learned a ton by studying what other YouTubers are doing. I'm not on YouTube, but what YouTubers are doing by like boat builders. I love following boat builders who, you know, it just makes your brain work a different way and you solve problems. Now, I'm not going into that saying, all right, I'm going to study this boat builder so I make better timpani mallets, but it happens. I'm interested in seeing how things are built and engineered, and that helps me solve problems down the road. Awesome. But yeah, don't just say, I'm going to make this, so I'm only going to focus on this. And I think most people who do that wouldn't do that, but yeah, just taking in as much information on whatever tangential things that are related to what you're doing can be super helpful. Like you can hear a difference with percussionists who only listen to orchestral music.
Sure.
Between orchestral percussionists who play drum set and listen to Afro-Cuban stuff or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So same thing with me and making things. Like I just don't make timpani mallets and drum pads. Like I've made furniture, I've studied with other woodworkers, which has no direct parallel to timpani mallets, but it really helps. You'll pick something up and then a year later it'll pop in,
yeah,
you know, indirectly. So yeah, for me it's just taking as much as you can on whatever you're studying, but try and find those things that'll open your brain up related to what you're doing. That's been huge for me. So
very cool. Yeah, I love that. Thanks for sharing.
Sure.
Last question is kind of for you. It's what activities and projects do you have coming up that you want listeners to know about? Anything special coming up?
I think I've pretty much saturated anybody that follows me on social media with tambourine obsession. That's just been a fun thing, and it's something I hadn't really thought about until about a year ago. But I'm really excited about those. I've been working with Mark Demolakis on those. He's in cool. Cleveland Orchestra. And yeah, it's been a very, all these things, everything with Ed, things with Leo, and now with Mark, it's just been a very organic thing. It wasn't like, I'm going to do this, whatever. It was like, I was interested, they were interested, we worked together, and it happened. And that's the way I like to work. It's never like, cool, I need to develop a product right now, I got to do this. It was always like, I'm interested, let's do this. So that's going to be, we're really close to finalizing, I guess, a line of tambourines with his, oh, wow, bearing his name on it too. So that's going to be cool. We're really pumped about him, but we've all got this pent up energy of wanting to go play music again. So,
oh, yeah,
or just getting it enough in a dose where you're like, I miss it. It's frustrating. I want more of it, but. So yeah, I guess that would be the newest thing. I don't really have anything. I'm going to try and just maintain what I'm doing. Maybe streamline some things so people don't have to wait so long for mallets or anything I make. But yeah, I gotta have some other things besides just working all the time. So
yeah.
If you're digging on the music that you're hearing, that was created by my good friend Ryan Robinson. The graphic design and logo work for this podcast was created by my good friend Janelle Ann. And thank you guys so much for listening, for tuning in, all the words of encouragement. I really appreciate it. Please head over and rate and review us, as well as shoot me a message about what you think. I'm always open to new ideas, new topics. I'm here for you. I appreciate you. Talk soon.